From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and today we bring you good food from Texas.
The thing you need to know about barbecue is it's really hard.
Really, with barbecue, if you think you've got it, you're pretty mistaken. You totally don't have it.
It's terrifying to talk about barbecue. It's such a contentious item.
Never real particular about it.
I guess the thing that you really have to know about barbecue is watching your heat.
And you know, you can't rush it.
Cooking it slow.
It ain't ready till it's ready.
Nobody else knows how to make it but Texans.
It's just really hard to say one particular thing. It's just, you keep watching it.
The thing that you need to know about barbecue is Aaron Franklin.
Yeah.
And get in line and have a few beers.
The line at Franklin Barbecue is exactly where we started our trip to Austin, Texas. Judging from the 100 or so people in front of us, it's where a lot of people start their morning in Austin. But by 9:30, when we arrived, we were already late.
My name is Bill Stevens. I got here at 6:30 a.m. and I'm fourth in line. There are people ahead of me, but you have to be here, otherwise you may not eat.
If you're gonna come wait, I say bring blankets if it's cold, board games, pass the time, beer if you're old enough.
My name is Warren McDonald. I got here at 6:30.
How many beers have you had yet today?
I've had three. But I have my son with me, and I usually am up to about 7 or 8 by now, so you caught me on a good day.
Last week, people were playing beer pong on the sidewalk, just stuff like that. It's like tailgating for barbecue, pretty much.
My name's Amethyst Fade, and basically my job is to go through the line and take an inventory of what we're going to be selling for the day so that we can let people know when we're going to be running out of stuff. And really, it's always going to be a wait, anywhere from 2 to 4 hours on average. So it's kind of no escaping it.
We work pretty hard to stay open for just a measly 5 hours. I calculated the stuff up recently, and for every brisket, it took us 44 man hours to produce that one brisket. That doesn't include service time. That's just to get it ready to serve at 10 a.m. We're cooking almost 24 hours a day, maybe hovering around the 2,000-pound mark for every day for all meats. To be open for 5 hours, it's pretty ridiculous.
Aaron Franklin just might be the biggest celebrity in Austin. He's the pitmaster at Franklin Barbecue, ranked number one on Texas Monthly's famous list of the top 50 barbecue joints. But there's more. Aaron's the host of a forthcoming PBS show, BBQ with Franklin, and he has a new cookbook out this spring. After a plate of brisket, ribs, sausage, and turkey breast, I sat down with Aaron and my barbecue-obsessed pal, Jonathan Gold, to talk about craft versus science. Here's Aaron.
You can't substitute craft for science. They're not interchangeable. They get along pretty well, and you can definitely play one off the other, but you can't just take one out of the equation. There has to be, like, human touch. There has to be hands. It's a craft. It's like roasting coffee, brewing beer, making barbecues, the same thing. So smoke's going to continue to penetrate, no matter if it's in a sous vide bag or if it's wrapped in foil or if it's just out in the open. But you're trying to regulate and, you know, keep as much moisture on the inside part of the meat. You're trying to dry out the surface to get a nice crust, what we call bark in this barbecue lingo. But you can't really do that in a bag. So then that comes with a craft. How do you change this? How do you make all these things kind of get along with whatever climate you're cooking in? So that's the crafty side. I think you can have both.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about, I mean, they can talk about temperature, they can talk about all kinds of things, but there's an appreciable difference in the quality of a fire, isn't there?
Huge difference. You know, if, say, you've got a gas-fired rotisserie, you've got heat, sure, it's from gas, that's cheating, but you've got like a green log and you shut a door, and that's a really dirty fire. It's an incomplete combustion. It's got puffy smoke coming out of it. That's not going to taste good. That's the kind of stuff you're going to belch up all day. You get a good clean fire, like say in an offset cooker or like maybe shoveling coals underneath a whole hog in Carolina somewhere. That's a clean fire. That's going to taste so much better. And kind of what we're going for here at Franklin Barbecue are like more delicate flavors. We're not looking for anything overwhelming. Really simple rubs, really high quality meat, and just really clean flavors. Everything should complement. It shouldn't lay on top.
And talk to me about the contrast in texture, particularly about the brisket, between the bark and the feeling of your teeth sinking through the bark into the meat.
Well, a lot of things. So you get a brisket. Obviously, there's different things going on. You've got the internal meat. You've got the, you know, the marbling. How well did it render? All that stuff. But then you get to the bark. So, you know, you take a slice of brisket or the end cut off of the flat. Of course, you want to take a bite, and it should be kind of firm. It should be smoky. That's where all the rub is, the salt and pepper. The pepper kind of melts into the fat, and then right below that, it's kind of buttery and velvety, kind of coats your tongue a little bit, and then you get to the meat. It's like a gobstopper.
And I understand that you don't like fresh pepper. You don't like using fresh pepper.
I don't like fresh pepper because, you know, and I say this in the book too, but we like to age our pepper. We like to grind it and keep it around for maybe a week or two, just to kind of let it die down a little bit. Because if you take freshly ground pepper and you put that much pepper on a piece of meat, it's going to be way overwhelming. It's going to taste so strong. So I like to let it kind of settle down a little bit. And that's because we're relying on a rough, coarse texture on the meat to help keep the smoke and help get color and get the texture that we're looking for. So it's a textural thing as well as a flavor thing.
A lot of what you do is being a wood whisperer. I mean, you seem to be able to pick up a piece of wood and know by its shape and the structure of it how it's going to burn before you even lay it down on the fire.
I think that's just from repetition. You know, the more you do it, you kind of know what you're looking for. You've got a coal bed going. Maybe you want a little bit of smoke. Maybe you need something that's going to give you really hot, fast heat. Maybe something that's going to last a little bit longer. So you kind of get a feel for it. You know, obviously, you pick up a green piece of wood or you pick up a really dry piece of wood. They're going to burn different. They're going to taste different. They're going to smell different.
Aaron, one of the things that really sets you aside from other barbecue pitmasters here in Texas is the sourcing of your meat.
We like good meat. You know, when I go to the grocery store or I'm cooking for friends at home, the last thing I would ever put on the plate is some commodity, like corporate-y, feedlot-y kind of whatever. And I'm sure not about to serve it at this restaurant. I really go to a lot of trouble to try to source the best brisket possible. Like right now, we're going through about 30 to 35,000 pounds of brisket a month. That is almost impossible to get something super duper ethical and super duper all natural and get 35,000 pounds of the same piece of meat. So we've kind of had to make some compromises. There's a lot of factors in there. I'll only cook Angus. That's the breed that I really prefer, as does most people. Not into growth hormones, not into unethical treatment of animals. Distressed animal is not a good tasting animal. You know, these poor things are giving their lives for us to eat. I'd like to do what I can to make sure they had a good life.
Talk to me a bit about the personality needed to do this kind of work.
I think it barbecue kind of found me in a lot of ways. You know, so I don't think you could really go into it and be like, oh, I'm going to cook. If you like to cook, that's awesome. But what do you like to cook? What makes you happy? That's what should guide you. I just happen to be really into fires and kind of like cooking meat and grilling and stuff like that. And, you know, somehow I've managed to base a career on like one piece of meat.
You talk about one piece of meat. Would you be happier if you just did brisket, or do you like having other things to play with?
It's complicated. One piece of meat would be pretty neat. You'd get really good at it. And that's kind of how I went about this whole thing. It's like, I'm going to learn how to cook brisket. When we opened up the barbecue trailer, I'd probably cooked one rack of pork ribs. I just never messed with them. You know, I was so gung-ho on getting this one piece of meat absolutely perfect. But I love brisket. Yeah. I think that's my point, is that I really like brisket.
And when you serve it, are you secretly like hoping that some people are going to ask for the point and some people are going to ask for the flat? Or do you have things to love about every part of it?
I celebrate both muscles on the brisket. It depends. I have a fun game in trying to guess what people are going to order. I'll do it at the grocery store, too. I'll be in the checkout line and be like, definitely a lean brisket kind of person, one slice of turkey. And then you see another guy and look at what he's got in his basket, you know, at the checkout line. And you're like, oh, yeah, fatty brisket. Give me that end cut, too.
Are we going to be seeing a Franklin branded home smoker anytime soon?
I haven't actually told anyone about this. We have a small welding shop, and my goal for some time this year, it's a back burner to a back burner to a back burner. I've got way too many other things going on, but I really want to start making little backyard pits. They'll be pretty heavy. They'll be built to last. They'll be smaller versions of what we use. The goal is that they won't ever get painted. They'll just beauties on the inside. We build them to cook well. And I think the way I hope to handle that is just sell them on a website, take a deposit, and then when it's done, you can pay for the rest of it.
I'd like to put my order in.
Oh, I already have
your order.
Thank you so much. What a great way to start the day.
Well, I'm glad to have you guys. Thanks for hanging out.
That was Aaron Franklin of Franklin Barbecue, along with my traveling companion, Jonathan Gold. Aaron's forthcoming book is Franklin Barbecue, a meat smoking manifesto.
Barbecue chicken, barbecue lamb, barbecue beef, barbecue ham. When you fix a table for me, make it plain barbecue, sweet as can be. Tell me, little mama, who you give my barbecue to?
While barbecue may be the most easily identifiable Texas cuisine, the last 10 years has seen a new type of chef climb the ranks of the Austin food scene. Paul Key is one of them. You may know him as the winner of Top Chef Season 9, but here he's a homegrown success story. His cooking style seems to be indicative of Austin, both casual and collaborative. He now owns a handful of food trucks, including Eastside King and Tycoon, which was on Bon Appetit's top 10 restaurant list last year. Plus, he has Key, his signature restaurant, where Jonathan Gold and I met up with him earlier this week. Hi, it's great to see you.
Hello.
Your food is an assemblage of flavors, textures from many different places. What do you call it?
I have no idea what I call it. that's like the hardest question for me. For me, the restaurant grew very organically. I love collaborating with my chefs. Not all the food's mine. I have ideas and I have a certain structure of how I like to eat. But at the end of the day, like, I love working with other chefs and I love working with my chefs into creating something unique into Austin.
And before this sit-down restaurant, you created sort of a little grouping of food trucks.
Yep.
Eastside King.
Eastside King.
And how long ago were you at Uchi?
I guess I left Uchi in 2009 to open Uchiko. And I was at Uchiko for about a year, year and a half before I left Uchiko and then opened Key. I actually opened Eastside King while I was there, and I also traveled and ate while I was there. Since I wrote the schedule, I always gave myself Sunday, Mondays off, so I'd fly to New York or fly to, like, somewhere else, you know, LA or whatever, San Francisco, and I'd try different food.
What kind of freedom did the trucks give you as a chef that you didn't have in a formal kitchen environment?
I think the trucks gave me a lot of confidence in a way, you know, because, like growing up as a cook in Austin, you know, like, I'm reading books like The French Laundry, and you're looking at stuff like, you know, Michel Brault and all these, like, fancy cookbooks, and I'm like, is this how food's supposed to be? I'm growing up as a cook. I don't really, you know, does it have to be white tablecloth, white plate all the time with fancy things on it, or can I use really big flavors? The first truck I opened was 6 by 8 feet. That was the square footage inside the truck, and I had a fryer and a microwave. So in a lot of ways, it was very liberating for me to try to create a menu based on that and still have it taste good, you know, without all the fancy stuff.
Was the microwave a conscious choice?
I mean, and I had an easy bake oven. Yeah, the microwave was a conscious choice. So I needed another heating element that could probably heat quick.
By easy bake oven, you don't really mean the one that cooks with a light bulb, do you?
No, it's like the electric one with the little knob and it goes ding, you know. And the way we wired it, like, or my friend pretty much made it for me. So we can't play the stereo and play the oven at the same time.
So lay it out for us in terms of the flavor palettes or what the plate structure is between Eastside King, Tycoon, and then here at Key.
Okay, Tycoon's pretty easy because Tycoon, I started with a friend of mine named Egnipon. His nickname is Ty because nobody could say Egnipon all the time. So he used to be a teppanyaki chef 10 years ago when I first met him. And then I started working at Uchi. I got promoted. Then he came and worked for me there. And he used to make the best family meals, you know. And then, you know, I started in the food truck game, and there was an opportunity for me to open a food truck with him. I'm like, dude, you can do whatever food you want there. I'll taste test, but it's your food. Do whatever you want. And it used to be stuff that, like, we'd get off of work here, go to his house, have beers in the garage, and they'd have this food there. And his dad owned a restaurant in town that ended up closing. But then I'm like, why doesn't your dad serve this food at that restaurant? He's like, oh, the customers aren't going to like it, blah, 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 blah. You know, I'm like, this is amazing. We should serve this food, you know? And that's how Tycoon got started. Eastside King, a lot of it was probably stuff that we made for family meal, I think, at first. You know, the chicken karage, the beet for home fries was an accident, because actually I remember I was yelling at some of the cooks because the beets were like a week old. And then my partner at the time, Moto, was like, fried it up. And then I'm like, were those beets? And then I'm like, he's like, yeah. I'm like, I think we could make some money off of that, you know? And we always ate chicken for lunch because I guess chicken's the cheapest thing to eat for lunch. So that's how that menu got started. As far as key, I think most people probably think I'm crazy because usually, like, most restaurateurs, right, you design a menu, you design the kitchen around the menu, then you design the restaurant around that. I think that's the conventional way to open a restaurant. I had no menu when I opened. I had no business plan. I just wanted to make sure that I could attract talent and make sure that we could have the freedom to fail and the freedom to evolve. Those are the three most important things to me with this restaurant. So if you think about in the year and a half that we were open, the first like 3 months was an a la carte menu. In the middle of that, I switched to pre-fee. Then we switched to most 90% reservations, and then we opened the tasting room. And then we started a Filipino menu on the patio. So it sounds a little crazy. Fortunately, we've had pretty good success. But at the same time, yeah, for me, key is all about having that freedom.
How important is Austin to that freedom?
I mean, it's pretty huge. One part of it is Austin, because Austin is a very, again, it's a very young town, young spirit, super brave. And being in Austin, you know, we don't necessarily have the rent that you guys have in California or the rent that New York has. The labor laws aren't quite the same. So actually, for a long time when I was cooking in Austin, it was like things were good enough, you know, in Texas. Like you can put together a restaurant, take home 20% to the bottom line and do okay. You don't need to do any better, you know? And when the trailer revolution happened, I guess, in Austin, it was a lot of line cooks and unhappy chefs that basically didn't want to work in these restaurants, open trucks, and made just as good or better food at cheaper prices. The attitude in the town was huge to it. Austin loves to promote itself, for sure. And, you know, we try to get each other's back.
One thing that seemed unusual about it is most chefs in your position with your shorter degree of respect came up through traditional French restaurants,
yeah,
and got the traditional French training. And yours was almost all in Japanese restaurants. How do you think that helps you to look at food differently?
I think a big influence for me with that wasn't necessarily that it was a Japanese restaurant, is that Tyson was a very open thinker. If you think of somebody mentoring you and be like, all right, this is how you make this dish, Tyson would give me a color palette and be like, here you go. And I'm like, what do you want with that, chef? And I just try to figure it out, give it back to him. He likes it, he doesn't like it, and go from there. So it was a very interesting relationship. And for me, him being that open about how he thought about food allowed me to be open about how I could view things, you know. When I think about it a lot, there's like too many like rights and wrongs with food. But like what's right in a French kitchen or what's wrong in a French kitchen is how my grandmother cooks at home. And is my grandmother wrong? No, you know what I mean? So like, as long as it tastes great for me, you know, like, I don't know. And it took a lot of years too, especially since I did cook in Austin, for me to get that confidence, because I would hire people underneath me to be sous chefs and chef de cuisines that have worked in Michelin starred kitchens. So like the way I learned, I'd always defer to them, see what their system is, and then try to learn from that. But I mean, being in Austin, being working for Tyson at the time gave me a lot of freedom and allowed me to open my mind a lot more. And it actually, you know, makes me appreciate not having gone to a big city. I feel like, you know, because I feel like a lot of chefs that I cooked with in the past that are cooking in New York now have too much tunnel vision when it comes down to food, you know. I'm like, and at the same time, like, you know, some of my best friends ended up cooking in New York, and I'm like talking to them about all these books that I was reading and all these chefs, and they're like, I don't know, I'm just working all the time.
Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Chef Paul Key. We've been sitting here at his restaurant, Key, in Austin.
Coming up, Jonathan Gold takes us on a crawl through the heart of Texas barbecue country, where we meet 79-year-old pitmaster Tootsie Tominetz, and we eat so much barbecue. Stay with us.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back to Good Food. We're on the road this week in Central Texas, searching for the state's best barbecue.
Barbecue is one of those binge foods.
people often, you know, tell you, yeah, I can go to three or four pits, and like, nobody goes out and has three or four different cheeseburgers in a day, or goes to Italy and goes and has four plates of spaghetti carbonara in an afternoon. It actually sounds like a good afternoon, come to think of it.
That, of course, is Jonathan Gold, who planned our barbecue crawl. Our first stop is Lexington, about an hour outside of Austin. It was there that we met one of the most famous pitmasters in Texas, Tootsie Tominitz.
When I started barbecuing, I had no idea it would get to something like this. My husband was working in a meat market in Giddings. There was only one person working the pit that day. The other two gentlemen had called in sick. So the boss asked my husband, said, do you think Tootsie would come in and help Orange out at the pit? So he called, and I said, well, yes. I said, I don't know that much about meats. And he said, well, anybody that can help will be better than nothing. Well, I guess I made them a good hand because they kept me on for 10 years.
Today, Tootsie has 50 years of barbecue experience under her belt. Now she tends the pits at Snow's in Lexington alongside Carrie Bexley. Back in 2008, Texas Monthly voted Snow's the number one barbecue joint in Texas, and it changed their business forever.
It blew our minds. I mean, all Carrie and I could do was sit in each other's arms and cry.
The first few years you were in this location, the crowds must have been much less, right?
Oh, it was very much less. In fact, I would get here at 2 o'clock a.m. Saturday mornings because I didn't have to have the briskets ready until around 10 when our local people came in to get something for Saturday lunch or Sunday lunch.
But people are here from all over the world.
Yes, from everywhere. I had a young man came and shook hands with me this morning from Hong Kong.
Have taste in barbecue changed, do you think?
Maybe a little bit. I don't know how or why. I mean, we only season with salt and pepper, and I can't really say why, but it seems like it's changed a little bit. When we were named number one and they told Carrie that our business would increase, and he told me, he said, we're going to have to stock up on briskets. And I'm going to back up here and say, when we were named number one, we did not have the big pits that we have here now. So we had to borrow pits, and they all cooked differently until he finally got the big water tank that he made our big brisket pit out of.
So you're cooking it longer now?
No, it's about the same. 2 to 10 or from 10 to 8.
Are you up all that time, or do you put them on and then someone else is sitting babying them while you go back to sleep?
Well, I fudge there. I stay at home until usually 2 o'clock a.m. I usually get here at 2 o'clock.
Did you get any guff from people for being a woman working the pits?
No, really not. They will just say, why do you think there are not more women that do it? I don't know. It's just something that I enjoy doing.
You seem made for it.
Well, thank you. And actually, I was raised on the farm, so I knew what work was. I was the oldest of three children. I was always with Daddy in the field, learning to plow and baling and raking hay and hauling cotton to the gin. We had a cotton gin here in Lexington at that time, years ago.
Pardon me for getting really personal, but would you share your age with us?
I'm very happy to do that. I'm very proud of my age. April the 21st, 1935, I was born here in Lexington. So when April comes around now in 2015, I will be 80 years old.
You look fabulous.
I've had a lot of people tell me that.
That was the one, the only Tootsie Tominitz. She and her business partner, Carrie Bexley, run the pit at Snow's Barbecue in Lexington. So why did we end up driving an hour outside of Austin to Lexington in the first place?
Yes, it does have to do with the fact that Snow's was voted number one by Texas Monthly back in 2008. But more importantly, it has to do with my compañero for this trip, Jonathan Gold. You know him as the critic for the LA Times, the belly of Los Angeles, and the only food writer to ever win a Pulitzer. But what you probably don't know is that he is a man who is deeply passionate about barbecue.
There used to be this almost religious fervor over the Texas Monthly Top 50 barbecue issue. I mean, I used to actually subscribe to Texas Monthly just to get that issue, which you couldn't really buy on newsstands in LA. And you'd sit there and you'd paw over the list and you'd see that, like, you know, Zimmer Hansel's or something went up a half star in the ratings. And you'd sort of dream of the day when you would be able to go and follow it.
How long ago were you here last?
It's been a while. I was here, I think, in 1999. I was doing one of my favorite stories that I've ever done. I was about to, you know, leave the LA Weekly to go to New York to work for Gourmet, and I'd been doing a lot of work for Travel and Leisure, so the editor, as sort of a benevolent gesture, offered me the chance to do any piece that I wanted. I could go anywhere in the world. And I think she probably thought I was going to go to, you know, Lyon and write about the haute cuisine, or go to Tokyo and write about kaiseki meals. But I asked her to rent me a Cadillac, fly my family to Austin, and we'd drive around for 2 weeks and eat barbecue. Central Texas, A, has always been, you know, cattle country. And there was a big German influx around the beginning of the last century. And a lot of them, you know, were meat guys, were butchers. And German food has always had a big tradition of smoking. And it sort of came to its perfect fruition with sort of the abundance of beef and a abundance of people who knew what to do with it. And barbecue has also been like a people's meat, right? I mean, you sell the primals, you sell your steaks, you sell the expensive parts of the cow, and then the parts of the cow that aren't so expensive, you would smoke because A, they would keep for a while, and B, you know, you get such a succulence from cooking low and slow and breaking down the connective tissue that would ordinarily make it tough and just making it just totally beautiful and luscious. And Lockhart, more than any other city, can probably be called the capital of Texas barbecue, which is, as Texans would say, means the capital of barbecue. There's Smitty's, which is in the building that's one of the oldest barbecues in the state. It's absolutely spectacular. We'll be there in a few minutes. It was, for most of its existence, called Kreitz, but there was a family feud, and half of them have a place out by the highway called Kreitz, and half of them broke off into Smitty's in the original building. There's also a place called Black's Barbecue in town that would be the best barbecue place in almost any town in Texas, but it has a lot of competition. And there's a fourth place whose name is escaping me at the point, which is the youngster in the game because it's only been there since 1968. Makes it practically an adolescent. And then there's a place that I absolutely love about 10 minutes south of town called the City Market in Luling, who I remember having maybe the best smoked sausage I've ever had in my life.
I seem to be on this trip drawn almost more to the sausage than anything else. which might seem heresy, but it's so good. It's so snappy and juicy.
That natural skin is a wonderful thing. And they all have that, you know, nice, peppery, coarse ground, totally juicy thing going on. And earlier this morning, I went to, like, we hadn't gotten plastic knives, so remember I picked up a piece of that sausage. I was going to snap off a piece, and the juice just catapulted across the table and into your hair. I'm sorry about that.
Take exit 470 onto US 183 South toward Lockhart.
She seems like a chicken wing kind of gal.
She probably does not have a hearty appetite.
We should ask her, where's the best place to eat barbecue, and see what she says.
What's the best place to eat barbecue in Lockhart, Texas?
The best rated restaurant is Black's Barbecue, located 8 miles to your south.
Humph.
I don't know who you are, but you can tell me. In Siri settings, tap on my info and then choose yourself from your contacts.
Snotty. We're at Smitty's Grocery in Lockhart, Texas, which is sort of the grand cathedral of barbecue, with, you know, huge high ceilings and, you know, vents that look like they were hacked out of ancient brick walls, and, you know, men, you know, hunched over the pits that are still huge live fires on the floor feeding into this flue, which is going through the pit, which is going up through this giant ceiling. It's just a magnificent machine. And after standing in line for quite a while, as is the custom, we ordered a bunch of fat and a bunch of lean. Fat is what they call brisket, and lean is what they call shoulder clod, which was the traditional Texas barbecue cut 50, 60 years ago, now supplanted by brisket, but is still really popular in parts of the state. We got some little ring sausages, and we got some ribs just because.
When we finished lunch at Smitty's, it was after 3 o'clock, which meant time to get back in the car and head to our last stop, Luling.
Luling itself is famous for a festival they have every year called the Thump Festival. It's a center of watermelon growing. and they have a thump festival, and every year they anoint a thump queen in her court.
Jonathan, as we approach our third stop of this barbecue crawl, I'm wondering if there is a strategy that we should be thinking of.
Well, I suppose the general strategy would be taste, don't eat. But so this food actually demands to be eaten. Part of it is like the having of the meat as opposed to the eating of the meat. And the idea that we're in a region we're probably not going to visit or revisit that soon. So there's a temptation to sort of taste everything everywhere in hope for that one perfect bite. We've done okay, though.
We did manage to find some room for ice cream cones.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't have had the ice cream cones been smoked.
When we arrive in Luling, the line is wrapped around the restaurant. There are families sprawled out across tables, butcher paper held down by mounds of meat, and styrofoam cups of neon big red soda. It's hot. The line is long, very long, and I admit I almost threw in the towel. Did we really need more brisket, more ribs, more sausage? But Mr. Gold Stamina never wavered.
Can I have a half pound of brisket, fat end, please? And one sausage and 3 ribs. And a couple pickles.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
As we settled into our booth, a gentleman exited the kitchen and with masking tape, put up a sign on the window. Scrawled out on butcher paper were the dreaded words, sold out.
Barbecue crawls are finite by nature because you can only start at a certain time. The lines are extremely long and the drives are long and places run out of meat. So we were the last people in line practically. And there were probably 50 people in line behind us who were incredibly disappointed when they
crushed. Can you imagine waiting in line for an hour and a half, and that's it, no more?
You have to console yourself with a block of cheese and some jalapeno peppers.
What time is it now?
5.
It's 5, and we started out at 8 o'clock in the morning for our first stop. So we've been at this all day. We've done 3, and at each spot, we've had almost the same cuts.
And there's a thing about coming to a restaurant once, especially a restaurant with as many variables in the cooking processes as barbecue. For example, I go to the same bakery for croissant probably 3 or 4 times a week. And I can almost tell you what the weather is outside by the consistency of the croissant, right? It changes that much. That I almost like run there when there's a Santa Ana because I know it's going to be, you know, crackly and crispy and almost definitely butterly. And on a day where it's sort of drizzly, maybe I don't even go there because I know it's going to be denser and not quite as like flaky as I would like. And it's like that with barbecue. Everybody we've talked to and everything we've tasted, there's so much difference in the wood, and there's so much difference in the way wood burns when it's windy out or when it's still, when it's just rained or when it's, you know, been hot and sunny, when it's been the sort of like 50 degree mornings we've been experiencing. And in the summertime, we're in central Texas, sometimes it's like 100 degrees for 2 solid months in a row without a break.
I have to thank you. Thank you for being so. We had this wonderful excuse to have this fantastic experience. What a treat.
It's been great.
Let's eat this apricot pie.
We have a ton of photos of our barbecue crawl on the Good Food blog. You can also find them on my Facebook page. While you're there, leave us a comment. What's your favorite barbecue place in Texas? What about here in LA? Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW, coming to you this week from Austin, Texas.
I don't even remember what day this is of our exploration of barbecue here in Austin and environs, but I do know that we have just met Mr. Daniel Vaughn of Texas Monthly, the only barbecue editor in the United States, for a really fabulous second breakfast of brisket tacos here at a place called Valentina's. So great to meet you.
Great to meet you too.
Great to meet everybody.
Welcome to Austin.
Thank you. The saga with Mr. Gold continues. For me, you know, I guess in terms of real Texas barbecue, I was total virgin before this trip. I feel like it's not what I thought it was going to be. And I'm really intrigued to talk about the urban versus rural thing that's really heating up here.
Yeah, well, for such a long time, barbecue really was just a rural phenomenon in Texas where it was all about the road trip. All the small towns had their own places, and most of the cities were places that had serviceable barbecue, but really nothing more, nothing that was destination worthy. And these days, that's changing pretty dramatically, and it's happening really in every city in Texas. Dallas has gotten some great places like Pecan Lodge, Lockhart Smokehouse, San Antonio, Houston, and then, of course, Austin, which has now become really the capital of barbecue, in my opinion, really in the country.
When you're talking about urban versus rural, you're not just talking about a very different kind of sense of place, but you're also talking about a different generation, aren't you?
Yeah, different generation. Most of the pitmasters that are opening up places in the cities, they're very often first generation pitmasters. A lot of the outsiders will say it's just all about hipster barbecue, right? Because it's all these young guys who have nice looking glasses and things. But you know, it's just one of those things that proves that if you have the passion and the dedication to do it well, you don't have to be a third or fourth generation pitmaster. These rules about what a good barbecue joint is, it doesn't have to be an old rundown shack that with a gravel parking lot and an old man working in the back. Like, if you have the knowledge and you're willing to apply it and you're willing to work hard, then you can get great barbecue, even if you're the first generation of it.
The Texas Monthly Top 50 Barbecue Things has been a Bible for people who love barbecue for a really long time. And it seems when you came in, at least it seemed like some sort of a generational shift, that you actually had a more open mind about what might constitute a great barbecue place than other people traditionally had.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I get lambasted quite a bit because I'm from Ohio. But I do think an outsider's perspective is helpful. I don't come with a lot of the baggage of what has to be traditional or what is good. I'm worried about the here and now. Like, I mean, I'm not going to walk into a place with white tablecloths and immediately say it's terrible without trying the food.
But what about when you talk about the white tablecloth? So this urban, I haven't had that experience really yet, where you walk into a very urban, hip restaurant environment where you're sitting down, there's cutlery. I have no idea how I would be able to gauge the experience, given that so much of barbecue has to do with a lifestyle.
Well, and the trouble with gauging barbecue like that starts with the fact that you are sitting down and you're getting served. There's something really special about the interaction between you and the person cutting your meat when you visit a more traditional Texas-style barbecue place. You can start telling a little bit about what that meat's going to taste like, or at least what the texture's going to be like based on just watching it being cut. You can also show them your preferences. You can ask for those little burnt edges that they might be throwing away that aren't presentable enough for, you know, fine china. So I think that interaction is so important that you do lose a lot of that at a white tablecloth place, or really anywhere that's serving barbecue out of the kitchen.
Another thing we've been noticing at even some of the best places is, like I can illustrate it by, I won't name the barbecue, but we were there, we were having a really good barbecue, and then Evan was sort of like poking around and looked over a thing that she probably shouldn't have looked over and saw big piles of boxes from IBP. And the idea of using such commodity-grade meat constantly, I know you talk about it in your book that like 9/10 of the pits use meat from the same packing house. It isn't necessarily the best packing house in the world. Why do you think there hasn't been more of a drive towards better meat?
Well, I think one of the things is just the history of barbecue being about taking a cheaper cut of meat and turning it into something great. It really just boils down to the fact that 95% of the beef that we produce is commodity beef in this country. And so the 5% that's left over is really expensive. Even the 95% of commodity beef is starting to get more and more expensive. And, you know, as much as we'd like to say we'll just charge more, that is something that an urban barbecue joint can do. You know, if you're in line at Pecan Lodge for an hour and a half, or you're in line at Franklin Barbecue for 3 hours, you're not coming up to the front of the line and saying, oh, well, that brisket's mighty expensive today, I'm just going to skip it. You're not even looking at the price. You're just, give me a pound of fatty and I want it now. Whereas if you're going into a place out in Llano, and that's the place you're going to every day, you're really going to pay attention to that price. Those barbecue joints out there, they can't just keep raising the price more and more. They're going to drive away their customers.
Yeah.
Because of your extensive knowledge, I don't think it's fair to talk to you without just talking about recommendations and just have you riff on some of the great stuff that you've been eating.
Yeah, well, you know, we're down here at South by Southwest, and I've been getting bombarded minute to minute with where to go eat around town here, and there's just so many great options. Of course, there's Franklin Barbecue. You've got the three-hour-long line, maybe 4 hours now that it's south by. La Barbecue is one that's just down the street from them. In fact, that zip code, 78702, is just jam-packed with great barbecue. Micklewaite Craft Meats, get some of their lamb sausage, really incredible stuff. And then we're over here on the other side of town at Valentina's Tex-Mex Barbecue. If you're looking for a great taco place and a great barbecue place, you don't need to go to two different ones. You could just come here. It's one of these places where, you know, a purist like myself who generally likes to just eat meat on butcher paper that's unadorned with anything, it kind of tests my mettle a little bit when I have to admit to myself that chopped brisket wrapped up in one of these fresh flour tortillas and topped with guacamole and salsa is pretty damn good.
This has been a terrific pleasure. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Yes, it's been great meeting you both. Thanks for coming to Austin.
That was Daniel Vaughn, barbecue editor at Texas Monthly.
Coming up, Jesse Griffiths is the chef owner at Dai Due, a restaurant and butcher shop in East Austin that's committed to honest ingredients and a style of old Texas chuck wagon cookery. Stay with us.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food, coming to you this week from Austin, Texas. Lest we give you the impression that Texas only serves meat from a smoker, I want to introduce you to a Texas native who admitted to me that barbecue was way too intimidating to discuss. This coming from a man who wrote a cookbook on hunting and butchering wild game. Jesse Griffiths is the chef owner at Dai Due, a restaurant and butcher shop in East Austin that's committed to honest ingredients and a style of old Texas chuck wagon cookery. Jonathan and I met up with him during lunch service to talk about his unique brand of locavorism.
I'm pretty fascinated by that, obviously, and we've also seen this movement grow a lot in the past 8 years that we've been open, from something that was a little esoteric to something that's becoming mainstream, as saying that, you know, they use local products. And I think along the way, what's really kind of guided us and informed our decisions is more of a desire to figure out, like, what the food from here should be, instead of just we get this from a farm. Just more of a what would our cuisine in this region be if it was unaffected by imports and commerce and the things that kind of have broken down our food systems. And so I think that's what really excites me, is because I like to look at this as a kind of a grand experiment and just seeing what we can glean from our own resources.
You know, coming from Southern California, where we have such a huge inventory of what's available year-round, sometimes I think that it's almost a disservice to have unlimited amounts of ingredients. And I think that sometimes creativity is really served better by limitations.
Absolutely. And I have to tell my cooks that all the time when we run out of onions, and sometimes they get frustrated by the fact that we don't have onions, you know. But we do have, they're tiny. There's a month or so where we don't have any, and then they'll be small, and then they grow, and then, you know, 7 months later we're back and we have the bulb onions, and they feel restricted by that. And I try to convince them to look at that from a different perspective and feel enabled by that, in that you always have a palette of ingredients to work with. In August and September, that is going to be exceedingly limited. And so we preserve and dry and ferment and try to make a palate in preparation for that, and it's fun, and it's a lot of thinking ahead, and there's no like calling a produce company at midnight and having stuff show up the next day. Really, you really have to be thoughtful about what you have, and you can't waste anything because it can be exceedingly valuable. The celery root might be gone next week, and at that point we're all going to be sad that we missed out. So when the sun's out, we make hay.
Does history come into it? Are you a history buff?
Yes. I mean, had I been a better student and gone to college, I probably would have gone into history because I'm fascinated by it. And I think that history has so much to say to us and inform the way that we eat. If it's even recent history, like the immigration of a lot of Vietnamese to this part of Texas or the Texas coast and how that's influenced our food in such a positive way, to things that go back 400 years, like the Spanish conquest of this part of the world. I love reading cookbooks from the 1890s, and I like to think our general manager was teasing me about this the other day about the way that I cook, and she's like, it's like a railroad car in the 1800s. I'm like, yes, you know, like to me it's like you start off with 2 dozen oysters, and then you have your terrapin soup, and then you have some magnificent roast, and you're drinking cognac and smoking cigars through the whole thing. And I love that kind of like hedonistic gout inducing style that they used to have. I don't think that we should eat like that all the time, but I think there's a certain romance to it.
Well, I'd say walking into Dai Due, which is also a butcher shop as well as a restaurant, the first thing your eyes are drawn to is that case of large cuts of meat aging. Sort of gives you an idea that you're into like old luxury.
Absolutely. And I mean, we are a meat-based economy here in Texas. Vegetables can survive and thrive here, but not always. But the steadfast product, the steadfast resource we have here is animals, I think. And that's another reason we chose to focus on animals. And we also like large cuts of animals for sharing. But I'm kind of fascinated by the whole beef rib, the big steak, the big pork chop, things like that. I like the large plates, kind of a retaliation against the small plates.
Do you ever find yourself like really profoundly wishing that you could serve shot game, or is the stuff you get from the farm sufficient for what you're doing?
Well, what we get is kind of a happy medium. We get trapped wild game. So it's coming off these big ranches. It's ostensibly wild. It's trapped and then brought into a processor. I'm happy with that arrangement. There has never really been a circumstance where I've, you know, thought like, oh, I wish I could just go out and shoot this stuff, because I understand that the burden that it would put on the resource and the complications, you know, through poaching and a lot of other things. It's a very complicated process that would be begun by allowing shot game or basically just, you know, anybody could go out and bring game in. I think it would complicate the status quo in a kind of a negative way.
But I noticed that your restaurant has feral hog on the menu. I don't think I've ever seen feral hog on a menu.
We get them in. They are like the other game. They're trapped wild and brought into a licensed slaughterhouse, processed there, stamped by an inspector, everything. But they do have to be brought in live. We really try to focus on feral hog a lot because of the nature of the resource. There's 2 million of them estimated. They don't respond to censuses very well, but there are a lot of them here. They're highly destructive. They're delicious. They're kind of the elephant in the room, I think, as far as food in Texas right now and like what's available. They're a huge protein source. They're exceedingly smart. They're hard to trap. I could and have definitely talked about them for hours before. So,
how is it different cooking a wild boar than it is cooking a domestic pig?
Well, they're always different. There's the big boars that are kind of stinky and have this kind of intense gaminess to them. The big sows that have a kind of a profound pork flavor to them but have a lot of fat. It depends on the size and the sex of the pig, really.
And you get different flavors depending on what they've been foraging on?
Absolutely. I define feral hog season, like the best time to pluck them, would be probably February through April, when they're just coming off of feeding on acorns for the whole winter.
I don't think we could talk about food that's of the place here without talking about Mexican food. Share with us some of your what really moves you, what inspires you, and are you doing a straight ahead version of what you've seen historically or what you've researched? Are you refracting it a bit?
A little bit of both. I mean, I think that you should definitely, you know, stay true to tradition, but I love Mexican food personally, and I think that it really, really speaks to this region, and also the treatment of the chili. Chilies do better here almost than anything else. And I also feel that our food should be spicy, and I think that's a profound influence that Mexican culture has had on this region. I mean, we used to be Mexico. I mean, we fought a battle a long time ago, and it decided that, you know, oh, we're not Mexico anymore, but I don't really think that it completely changed. And I love the fact that we are in this region so heavily influenced by Mexican culture and food. And like I said, I think more than anything is our heavy use of chilies and things is kind of a nod to that.
So when I think about this part of America / used to be Mexico / used to be Spain, I think about wine. And I noticed that your wine list really represents that. Tell us about it.
Maybe the thing I'm most proud about in this restaurant is our wine list. And it's also the thing we probably get the most criticism about and people like smirk and talk about is because Texas is not famous for its wine. But we could not conscientiously wrap our heads around having this type of restaurant that focused so much on seasonal and local ingredients and what we could extract from this region and then not support the Texas wine industry. So when we started off, I will admit it was difficult. We were scared. We didn't know if we'd be able to fill out a list. We thought maybe we'd have maybe 4 or 5 wines. And then we started tasting wines that were not only just decent or good, that were great. And we can just laugh and poke fun at Texas wine forever, or we can steward it and be a legitimate restaurant that serves it and be proud of it and try to help that industry become better. And I mean, the grapes will grow here. Some years are harder than others, but if we take care of it and steward that community, then it will get better.
Jesse, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Wonderful to actually be here.
Jesse Griffiths is the chef owner of Dai Due, a restaurant and butcher shop in East Austin. We recorded so many interviews this week that you're going to hear some of them on future episodes of Good Food. A big thank you to Mr. Gold, who spearheaded this meat venture with me, and to Jillian Ferguson, who produced today's show from the road here in Austin. And Lynn and Jason Bentley are around the corner at the Cedar Street Courtyard. They have some new music for you, so keep it locked right here on KCRW from Austin.
The one thing you have to know about barbecue is put the smoke in the meat and not on the street.